Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events. And today we have a very special guest. Jake Tapper is joining us this evening. He's going to be talking about his new book, The Devil May Dance. And as you know, Jake Tapper is the author of The Hellfire Club, which is being turned into a TV series by HBO Max. I'm sure we'll talk to you about that, as well as The Outpost, which became a celebrated film released in 2020. An award-winning anchor for CNN, he joined the network in January 2013. He lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife, daughter, and son. And as I said, his brand new book is called The Devil May Dance. Barbara's holding up a copy there. And welcome, Jake. It's great to see you.
It's great to be here and it's an honor to be here with at the legendary Poison Pen with Barbara Peters and the rest. Thank you so much for having me. Next time in person.
That would be wonderful. Yeah. So let me say first that this is a wonderful book and autographed copies are, even as we speak, leaving Jake's office in Washington, D.C. and moving toward Scottsdale, Arizona at the mercy of UPS. So eventually they will arrive. Second, a toast to you, Jake, because this is your official publication day, even though you've been already at work.
Right. Thank you so much. I need to get somebody to grab me a drink. If I'd known this was a BYOB, I would have brought plenty of B.
Our events are BYOB. It just depends on the time of day. So I find it really unnerving to have one's life turn into history. I was born in 1940. I graduated from Stanford in 1962, the year that this book takes place. And one of the things that was revealed to me reading this book was how little we actually knew about the lives of many of the people that Jake depicts. It was though you ripped a bandage right off my eyes on some of them. However, there are three who actually played a part in my life, minor parts anyway, well, one major actually. And I thought that there's a wonderful review in, the Wall Street Journal, which was entitled Jake Tapper on Writing Books in 15 Minutes a Day, which he can discuss. But the pertinent comment I thought was when you were talking about how do you capture a character and bring it to life that people think they know because they're historical figures, how do you reveal parts of them that make them feel more like people? For Joe McCarthy, I tried to capture his charisma. Well, let me tell you, I grew up north of Chicago on the North Shore, and I remember every moment of Joe McCarthy. And you are so right that it's almost impossible to bring that magnetism, that charisma, until we had Donald Trump, back to life. How did you do it?
Well, for Joe McCarthy, I mean, he doesn't age well, right? I mean, you look at the clips of him talking. And obviously, he's one of American politics' greatest villains, but he seems very histrionic. But that's looking at him from the 21st century. He came out of nowhere. He wasn't born to the manor. I mean, he was self-made, and very charismatic. And you know, I was writing that book, the Hellfire Club. At the same time as the Trump phenomenon was happening, he was about to be elected. And there were so many parallels, of course, including, of course, that Joe McCarthy's protege was Roy Cohn and Roy Cohn's protege was Donald Trump. But beyond that, I mean, I just thought, like, in order to understand how Joe McCarthy came to power, you have to understand that people were drawn to him. People liked him. And I read a fantastic biography of McCarthy written in 1952 by Jack Anderson that really captured this. And I thought to myself, I really need to capture that. I need that to be part of this, because otherwise he's just a caricature. He's just a villain. And I need Charlie, the main character, one of the two main characters, to find that compelling. And the same thing with Sinatra in this book, which is, it's very easy to caricature him, and Gary Trudeau has done a great job when he used to make fun of Sinatra in Doonesbury, but people loved Sinatra, and he was a complicated person. And he had had his heart broken by Ava Gardner, and he was on the forefront of civil rights legislation. But that said, obviously he was a pig in a lot of other ways, with women especially, and probably bipolar, probably had some sort of mood disorder. So it was just like capturing all of it. Nobody, the main lesson about being a Washington, D.C. correspondent is nobody thinks they're a villain. You know, there are villains, but none of them think they are. They all think that they're the heroes.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, McCarthy was right over the border in Wisconsin, but it was a longer way than you might think from Chicago to Wisconsin. So he was a phenomenon that really unnerved us. So the other two characters that I was fascinated to read about, Rock Hudson was known to us as Roy Fitzgerald. He was born in 1925 and he went to New Jersey High School, the high school that I went to. And he graduated when I was only 3 years old. But by 1954, after the Magnificent Obsession, his name was rung around the high school because he was kind of a celebrity. And I discovered to my astonishment that he had been my grandmother's mailman. That was one of his part-time jobs as Roy Fitzgerald, which was his stepfather's name. And he was this tall, gangly guy. And, you know, I can remember what a heartthrob he was, you know, and how excited the high school was. And honestly, it wasn't until the AIDS epidemic that anybody, you know, any of us were able to work out, as you present in your book, that in fact he had a very heavily, concealed, is that the right word? Anyway, he was gay at a time when people didn't come out. So, you know.
Not only gay, but like liked young men, was always surrounded by a bunch of young men. And he's a bit character in The Devil May Dance, but one of the things that there's an allusion to, because I thought it was so interesting, is in that era, early 60s, and it was a big time for him. He was doing all those movies with Doris Day, and he was this huge, you know, romantic lead, as you know. And there was some photograph of him like wearing a fur coat, and everybody thought it was so funny because he was such a manly man. Like, who would ever believe such a thing, that he was, you know, gay? That's not how they would have put it then, but yeah.
My point is, before social media, the internet and so forth, how little we actually did know about public, you know, celebrities, whether they were movie stars or politicians and so forth. I mean, none of us really knew about Kennedy in the Lincoln bedroom, you know, when he was in the Lincoln bedroom. But the other character that I really think is interesting, and this is the quiz. So I'm going to have Patrick, I sent him a couple of photos. I dug out my New Tier High School yearbook and I took two photographs. So there's another bit player in your book, but a big player in my life. Let's see if you can recognize who this is.
Okay.
Let's see here.
Sorry, Patrick, am I challenging you?
No, that's okay. Hold on.
Okay, so there is the first photo. Does this ring any bells with you, Jake?
The face looks really familiar.
It does.
This one right here in the center?
Right, the center photo, right? And then there's another photo, which will show both of us, actually.
Okay, let me see the other photo.
Let's see here. How about this one? This one, Barbara? That one.
All right, and so you want to go to the upper, that one is the person in, I am in the middle with the long hair in this, in the first row, that's me. But that is she up there. So does this ring any bells for you?
This will give you a hint right here.
It looks so familiar, but I can't.
Here's well, the last name.
It's not Shirley MacLaine.
No, to give you a hint, she probably, I think that her first movie had debuted the year before your book, and she hadn't yet morphed into the persona that we all know, because I remember going to see it, and she still was dressed in like net formals and looked very much like she looked in high school, but she was a wonderful person. I haven't talked to her for 63 years, and it was so interesting to see her pop up on that. So that is actually Anne Margaret.
Oh, is that Anne Margaret?
Margaret, right.
Yeah, the first one looks more like her. Now that you say, the first one looks more like her. And,
But you know, in your book, she does appear in the background. She was 2 minutes in your book, but I was thinking to myself, we're the same age, so she would have been 21 in 1962 and barely had dipped her toe into Hollywood and this whole thing. And I thought, you know, you've got her there on the edge of this Rat Pack, which is a really scary company for somebody as young and unsophisticated as she is. So, you know, I found reading when you are stripping masks off a lot of people in this book, I was trying to imagine, I mean, I knew her as Annie, and because her parents, they lived, her mother had a job that had them living above a garage in Wilmette, Illinois. So she was a girl in a very wealthy high school who had very little money and had, as if I remember it, like 4 sets of clothes or something. And
amazing.
And I used to lend her, I did on one occasion, I can remember for sure, lend her my clothes in order for us to sing in a public place because she couldn't afford them, which led to a terrible fight with my mother, but we won't go there. Anyway, and I thought to myself, how she must have felt, you know, on the fringe of this group from that background, you know, and I also thought,
imagine what it was like to be a young woman.
Well,
Exactly.
And, you know, I just can't imagine. I'm hoping that one day I may catch up with her because we're both still here and ask her about that. I've always kind of wondered what it was like for her to make that transition so abruptly from New Trier to Northwestern to George Burns and Hollywood and then an observer in your book.
I'm going to help quickly. I'm going to help David get back on screen. His publicist is emailing me. So I'm going to go off screen for a little
while. We're missing
while,
David. Okay? We were killing time here for David Baldacci to return. But nonetheless, I thought, Jake, I'm the only person who could possibly talk to you about this that way. So maybe it would be fun.
And you know, knowing, like, yeah, having personal connections to a number of the characters in the books, it's amazing. You should definitely reach out to Anne Margaret. I bet she'd love to hear from you. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to get, so I think she shows up in a scene at the Daisy Club, which was a private club that really existed. And it started in 1962 in Los Angeles. And it was a place where people like Frank Sinatra and Anne Margaret and Shirley MacLaine could go and not be hounded by fans, a private club, a private dinner and drinking club in Beverly Hills. And one of the things in the book, one of the kind of subtexts of the book is, what was it like to be a woman in Hollywood during this era when men were brutes and celebrated brutes? As you note, when there was so much going on that we didn't, that society didn't know, whether about President Kennedy or Frank Sinatra or Sam Giancana, the mobster or whatever, so much not, you know, that the public was oblivious to.
You know, this book, it's only 60 years ago in time, but the divide between the internet age and the before age is so huge that it could be centuries back if you think about it. And the sorts of things that you're writing about, the, you know, the ability that muzzling the gossip columnists or getting them to write only what you wanted to, sending your guy undercover to see what was going on in Palm Springs, would be virtually impossible today.
Yeah, although before the internet was what it is now. So in the, I wanna say like around 2003, 2004, I was at ABC News at the time and I did a piece for Nightline about the gossip industry. And I don't think it's necessarily the same today, but it's still some, there's still a lot of trading.
Sure.
There's still a lot of powerful PR people trying to keep certain stories out, trading other stories for to keep those ones out. And obviously some of the what Ronan Farrow writes about in his book, Catch and Kill, I think it's called, about you know, what David Pecker at American Media was able to do with all those stories supposedly about Donald Trump. You know, I think that still goes on to a large degree, but as you note, the internet has made it difficult for people to keep as many secrets as they used to be able to.
Well, the thing is that the gossip columnists were really the gatekeepers to gossip, you know, Luella Parsons and all of that. But today you can't really keep out all the people with their phones that, and before, even if people had access to a camera and a celebrity in an unhappy moment or something, they didn't necessarily have a channel to, you know, to publish it. But today, you know, anybody can do it. I mean, sure. We see it at book events all the time. You know, people queue up for hours with in front of authors. And it's really about, it's not so much about talking to the author or even getting the book signed. It's about getting a photo so they can curate their own story on their own social media. I was here right. with Jake Tapper. Right. Well, none of that was available at the time that you were writing about.
Yeah. And Luella Parsons, who's also in the book, although not as a character, but Sinatra hated her so much because she would write things about him that he didn't like, you know, about his the turbulence of his career and his love life. And he really hated her. But the gossip columnists were very powerful. Luella Parsons and Walter Winchell and others. And in fact, there's a sub plot having to do with the Church of Scientology.
Right.
And this thing that they had called Project Celebrity, which was, and this is real, where L. Ron Hubbard wanted to start enlisting famous people to become Scientologist, something that he has now done very successfully with Tom Cruise and others. But in the book, this is the early days of Project Celebrity, and they have listed a number of people that they want to enlist, to draft, and a bunch of gossip columnists are there among the other famous celebrities of the time because they were so powerful. But that didn't mean that they shared everything that they knew. It actually meant quite the opposite.
I can remember riding my bicycle up to Uptown Winnetka and buying Photoplay, which was, you know, a magazine, a published magazine with various gossip columnists and so forth writing it. But by today's standards, it was so vanilla, the stuff that they would reveal. It wasn't the really, you know, difficult stuff. It was more enhancing their image kind of stuff. But I mean, I can remember reading it. I also remember hiding them under the covers, you know, because my parents disapproved of it. So it wasn't actual pornography or anything, but it wasn't sort of elevated reading to have parents. See, what's interesting, you know, is reading your book at my age, because I lived through it, as opposed to, let's say, a reader, you know, younger than you, reading it, and all of this is history to them. So that's what we found so fascinating about it. I don't know if we're going to get David Baldacci with us or not. I was holding off asking you to tell us about the book, but maybe you should go ahead and give us your pitch.
For those people who don't know, David Baldacci is having internet problems, and we're trying to get him on. So hopefully we'll get him back. He's such a master, and I'm actually in the middle of reading one of his more recent books, One Small Favor. He's such a great author.
And here is David's actual
Gambling Man. And that's the second book in the Archer series. Yes. One Small Favor is the first. So you should definitely read David Baldacci. If he doesn't make it back, you should read his books, because they're I'm in awe. And in fact, the Archer series kind of reminds me of, I told him this, there's a Steinbeck kind of style to it in terms of the setting and in terms of the writing. I just find lovely. Anyway, so my book, The Devil May Dance, is based on and inspired by a true story. And that true story is, in 1960, Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack, who were among the most famous actors and singers and entertainers of their era and had been for a decade or so, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, Joey Bishop, and there were a number of others also, and Shirley MacLaine, other people who were, you know, along with the crowd. And they worked their tails off to get Senator John F. Kennedy elected president in a very, very close election, unbelievably close. And then they were, you know, part of the whole ball and festivities. And Sinatra was really enamored with John F. Kennedy. I mean, he really loved him. And Peter Lawford, who was an actor in the Rat Pack, was also, he had married John F. Kennedy's sister, Patricia. So there was this connection. Sinatra, anticipating a time that President Kennedy would come out to California, started building up his estate in Rancho Mirage, which is near Palm Springs. It's called, what's called the compound, and building it up and preparing for a presidential visit, building rooms, telephone lines, built a helipad. And Kennedy, President Kennedy was supposed to come out in March 1962. He was going to come out. And this is, again, this is all the real story. And Attorney General Kennedy, Robert Kennedy was going to war against organized crime. And he had fought publicly during a hearing when he worked in the Senate with Sam Giancana, a Chicago mobster. He was also a friend of Sinatra's, like an actual friend who had stayed at the compound. So then the dilemma happened. Attorney General Kennedy, what is he going to do? Is he going to let his brother stay in a compound where a mobster had actually slept before? Or was he going to seriously offend one of President Kennedy's most public backers? And that is the premise of the book. And that is a real story. And what I did is I took Charlie and Margaret. Charlie's a congressman from New York and Margaret's his zoologist wife. And I have that Kennedy sends them out to investigate Sinatra to see if he's really mobbed up. And that's the premise of the book. And Sinatra at the time is filming the Manchurian Candidate, and Charlie becomes a consultant because he is a hero and also a member of Congress. The book, and you know, it's about the Rat Pack, and it's about the mob, and it's about the Kennedys, and it's about conspiracies, and it's about Charlie and Margaret, our heroes. And I've been lucky enough to get some nice reviews from Publishers Weekly and the New York Times and Booklist, and that's the premise.
The New York Times, I thought, was a wonderful review. I really enjoyed reading it. And one of the things that I think you did extremely well was writing about Charlie and his PTSD and how he's trying to cope with it at a time when that wasn't necessarily diagnosed. I don't know that PTSD was actually a thing in 1962.
Yeah, they just called it shell shock.
I mean, people did, but it wasn't as well established as today. So he keeps trying to quell it with alcohol, which is really putting a big strain on their marriage. And I thought that you wrote that very realistically. So many of the people who served in the war, most of them, in fact, never talked about it. You know, it wasn't one of those a public airing, so to speak, of the experiences and the trauma that they went through. And alcohol was certainly a way to try to deal with their demons. But I mean, that's a through line in the book, and a suspenseful line is, you know, Charlie going to beat alcohol, or is alcohol going to beat Charlie? And what effect will that have on Margaret? Which I thought was very well done.
Thank you so much. And also the idea being, Charlie's having a problem with alcohol because it's the way he calms himself from his PTSD. And it doesn't help to then go hang out with Sinatra and the Rat Pack, who are drunk all the time, legitimately drunk all the time. And throwing himself into that situation, what does that do to a person? And that's one of the themes of the book also, is what happens to you when you dance with the devil, when you become acquainted with somebody who is of lower moral fiber than you, whether it's mobsters and Sinatra or the Kennedys and the Rat Pack, and there's, you know, other stuff that goes on in the book. But when you compromise by hanging out with people who are fun but maybe undermine your moral fiber a bit, what does it mean? What price does it cost you? And that's one of the themes of the book. And that's why it's called The Devil May Dance, because that's a fictitious Sinatra song that is kind of the theme of the book. And in fact, Barbara, you'll appreciate this. So, you know, when you write a book, you can use one line of from a song and that's it. Or else the lawyers say you can't use more than one line. I mean, one line. I mean, like she gets hungry for dinner at 8. Bang, that's it. Nothing more than that. Because people might sue the people who own the rights to the song. So I've been through this before with my first book. anyway, so I get a call from the lawyers when they're going through the manuscript, and they're like, what are you doing? You have an entire Sinatra song in here. It's intertwined in the climax of the story, and you can't use any of it. You know that. We'll get sued. And I said, it's not a real song. It's not a real Sinatra song. I made it up. All the lyrics are mine. It's all fictitious.
So you have a second career. I love it. You're gonna.
Well, I don't have a melody. I don't have a melody. But those are the lyrics. And by the way, and just so people understand, I'm not saying it's a good song. I'm just saying it's a believable 1962 Sinatra song. Like it's. I'm not saying like, oh, somebody should actually record this. No.
That's so funny. Right. Fair use doctrine. It kills you every time. And it, oh. You know what, Jake? It isn't just song. It's poetry. You yep. can't. You the same thing applies, and fair use can be really difficult to determine and very expensive if you screw it up. But you know, going back to your point about The Devil May Dance, if you have two characters who are married and they are not necessarily in the same moral balance, you know, that adds a lot of tension to a marriage as well. But I did want to touch also because Sammy Davis Jr., as you point out, is a character in this. And you know, racism was alive and far more blatant than it is currently. I can remember my father using some casual phrases that would really be horrifying today. And yet they meant nothing special to him because everybody talked that way. But I thought that you did do a very delicate but powerful job with Sammy and, you know, what he had to face.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot. First of all, let me just say, Frank Sinatra, whatever you think about him, and his, you know, his behavior with women or his behavior with the mob or whatever, he was way ahead of his time on civil rights.
He was.
Way ahead. And fought for the right of Sammy Davis Jr. to integrate the hotels in Vegas and the people in his band. He was great on those areas. And in fact, in many ways, and there's a scene, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a scene, Charlie's best friend in the Hellfire Club and also in The Devil May Dance is a black congressman, Congressman Isaiah Street, fictitious from Chicago. And Isaiah Street knows Sammy Davis Jr. in the book, because they both were in the army in World War II. Isaiah was a Tuskegee Airman, but anyway, he knew Sammy Davis Jr. But what Sammy Davis Jr. went through in the army was so awful and hideous. It's why his nose was the way it was, because it was broken in the army by these racist white soldiers. And I really came to have a much greater understanding and appreciation of Sammy Davis Jr. and everything he had been through to become the celebrity he was. And, you know, the Kennedys made him delay his wedding. He was married. He married a white woman, Mae Britt, and they made him delay his wedding until after the 1960 election because they were embarrassed. Because the Rat Pack was associated with the Kennedys. He was not invited, Sammy Davis Jr., even though he had helped Kennedy to perform at the inaugural ball. There were black artists who were, but they had black wives, like, you know, Harry Belafonte. And I mean, Frank Sinatra was way ahead of where the Kennedys were at that point and what Sammy Davis Jr. went through. Because, you know, I'm 52. I knew Sammy Davis Jr. at the end of his life. I knew him kind of like as a caricature. And he was, I think he's amazing now. Now that I know about his life and everything he went through to get where he was. I just have such a great appreciation for him.
He was a phenomenally talented performer. And actually, for anybody who's interested in looking at this, PBS, I can't remember who it is anyway. No, it's, anyway, it's called Genius. And I can't remember if it's which of the many streaming channels is doing Genius. But they have done a three-part episode, or maybe five, about Aretha Franklin, which is absolutely, you know, spot on from what you are talking about. They also did Picasso and I think Einstein, but the Aretha Franklin one really brings home how what it would have been like, you know, from the perspective of a Black performer. And I guess the movie that that was out that got so many Academy Award nominations and so forth was another one, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Yeah. You know,
another example of that. And we can look back at that now through a lens of history and, you know, sympathize with the characters. But at the time, there wasn't a lot of sympathy with the characters, and they were very much isolated from the mainstream.
I heard a great podcast, and I forget what it was, but it was a great podcast about Sammy Davis Jr. endorsing Richard Nixon in, I forget if it was 1968 or 1972. I think 68 when Richard Nixon ran for president, but maybe 72. And all the heat that he got. But I think one of the things people forget is the experience that many Black celebrities had in the 1960 election. Remember, Jackie Robinson endorsed Nixon in 1960. The way the world looked in 1960 was so different from the way the world looked in 1968 in terms of where Democrats and Republicans were on issues of race. And if you're Sammy Davis Jr. and you know how cruddy the Kennedys were to you personally on issues of race, maybe you would not think there was actually that much of a tremendous difference between Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey or Richard Nixon and George McGovern. I mean, that might be one of the contexts. This is not in the book at all, but I'm just thinking, like, if you have this experience where President Kennedy and Ambassador Kennedy have you move the date of your wedding. And this book is not an anti, this book is not an anti-Kennedy book. But it's just, all these people are very complicated and complex. But that was Sammy Davis Jr.'s experience. It's possible President Kennedy didn't even know about it. It was Ambassador Kennedy that made him do it. But if that's your experience, maybe you would think, like, the Democrats and Republicans in 1968, they're not different on race. Who cares? I don't know.
Well, you're right. But I mean, the key to this is how complex these characters were. Sinatra was, you know, an enormous stew of both good and bad, and, you know.
Absolutely.
And of course, you know, his talent was tremendous and his ability to connect with an audience was tremendous. I can remember listening to The Wee Small Hours of the Morning was like a lullaby. You know, I used to play it when I was tired and wanted to go to sleep. And it was, I mean, really mesmerizing. However, I want to go back to something. You know, I'm actually a big historical novelist fan. And so I know a lot of weird things. And one of them I know is that what you are talking about with Kennedy wanting the president, John Kennedy, to come to Palm Springs and going through all the trouble of upgrading his house and putting in the helipad and so forth was exactly the way the courtiers of Elizabeth I played. I mean, they dared themselves, you know, to enhance their castles or manor houses. They would spend a fortune on, you know, creating a bedroom for the queen or something. It bankrupted them when she showed up with her zillions of retainers, and it was all on the house and they had to feed them and so forth. But there was something, you know, about having her in their home that was like an incredible, I don't know what, whether it was a status symbol or touching royalty or, you know, touching power. Maybe that's really it. So I thought of that when I was reading about Sinatra. That's, and I thought, this is not new behavior. This is actually behavior that has gone on for centuries.
That's true. But I also think that Sinatra platonically loved Kennedy. I think that was a heartbreak, the same way Ava Gardner broke his heart when she cheated on him with that matador in Spain. And you know, that's, I think that was his second wife. And that, you know, it made him an incredibly gifted singer of torch songs. Yeah. And you could hear the loneliness in his voice for the rest of his life and the anger, but it broke his heart. And I think Kennedy did that to him too. And you know, there's a scene at the end of the book that takes place in, you know, it's funny. I was looking for, I knew how the book was gonna end, but I didn't know where it would end or the context of how it end. So it's at this point, I'm up to April, 1962. And because the visit to Los Angeles is May, And then, so then I'm just like trying to figure out, okay, how do I end it? So I just start looking through newspapers, old newspapers on newspapers.com. And all right, what happened in May 1962? Well, Marilyn Monroe singing Happy Birthday, Mr. President to John F. Kennedy at a huge birthday fundraiser for him. Peter Lawford's there, you know, all these Hollywood stars. You know who's not there? Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra is not there, despite being his number one celebrity supporter, not there. And I think that John F. Kennedy, and this is implied, but not a major part of the book, in terms of what happens after, you know, in the future, I think Kennedy broke his heart. I think Kennedy broke his heart. I don't think it was just like, oh, I wanted a famous person or I wanted my buddy, the president. I think that made him angry and bitter. And I think it probably chased him into the arms of Ronald Reagan a decade and a half later.
Now, one of the wonderful things about fiction and about writing about real people, but writing about them in fiction rather than trying to write a biography, which necessarily has to be more distant and more scholarly and so forth, is that you can let your imagination fill in or, you know, color the whole thing. And I often think that the truth of people's lives is better rendered in fiction than it actually is in biography. And this is an example of it.
Because people deny it and people aren't aware of it. And people, you know, put up shields, right? We all do. We all do that. We conceal the hurt that we carry with us, and we deny it to our, you know, we don't have biographers, but we deny it to the biographers in our head. And I do think that was a major turning point in Sinatra's life. And you know, I joke about it towards the end, like, I don't want to spoil anything, there's just like, you know, Margaret, who is Charlie's wife, the two main characters in the book are Charlie and Margaret, and Margaret is the core, the moral center of the family, and she is also the stronger of the two, both ethically and also just as a person. And Margaret is worried about Sinatra. Margaret worries about him. I'll talk more about that with people who have read the book, and I don't want to spoil it for anyone.
If that's the unfortunate thing about doing events at the very outset of publication, is that you have to be so careful. We've actually started doing some book discussion follow-ups to events like this, where everybody can get back together and talk about the whole book, you know, which
I'm game. I'm definitely game.
Well, it would be fun, you know, because I find it very frustrating, because sometimes the reasons that I like a book as well as I do are the things I can't talk about without ruining, you know, it's very frustrating. But let's, before we call Patrick up, because it's bound to be a question, this is the second book that you have written about murders, and I'm assuming that you are going to go on. What is the, because people always want to know this, is there a translation into film? And if there is, are you excited about it? And what do you think that might bring to your plan for continuing with them?
Well, we developed a pilot with HBO Max. Mark Smith, who wrote The Revenant, wrote the pilot, and he's so good and so gifted, and we're trying to turn it into a streaming series. HBO Max is not attached to it anymore, so right now me and Mark and our team are trying to, you know, we're trying to work on it. It's not easy to pitch a period piece, because it's more expensive for the clothes and the cars, but we're confident that we'll find someone to make it. Right now we're just shopping around for producers, and then we'll try directors, and then we'll try actors, and then we'll present a package to Netflix and everyone else. But season one would be The Hellfire Club. Season two would be The Devil May Dance. And then you can really do anything with it you want. I mean, I would love to have, assuming it got picked up, I would love to have season three be a mystery that takes place with Isaiah Street, the Black congressman, except back when he was a Tuskegee Airman. That would be fun to do a season like that. There is also the idea, and this might be for my next book, you know, Charlie and Margaret have two kids, Dwight and Lucy. Well, Dwight will be turning 18. He'll be turning 18 in 1976. So there's any number of things you could do with Dwight as a main character or Lucy as a main character in the 70s and 80s, given that Charlie and Margaret might be a tad long in the tooth to be running around the Reagan, Washington, D.C. era, but maybe not. I mean, I think my publisher is interested in, I think Dwight will be the character, the main character in the next book.
So your publisher is, or you have fully embraced the idea of continuing to be an author in addition to your distinguished career in journalism and television, right?
I really like it. And the first book was a bestseller. And I mean, I have no idea what's going to happen with this one, but Janet Maslin doesn't exactly give away, you know, rave reviews. So I'll believe her review for now, her positive review in the New York Times for now. And yeah, I mean, I think it's fun. And there are a lot of really gifted, far more gifted than I, writers out there. David is one of them, although clearly not gifted with the internet. At least his provider isn't tonight. But that said, I think my historical fiction series is fun, and it's fun for me to write. And you know, if people like reading them, I'll keep going.
Oh, you're not necessarily limited to writing about the murders in historical fiction. You know, I mean, one of the great things about being an author is that you can create a universe as you wish. So, you know, who knows? You might, you know, I myself have heard any number of writers that I have spoken to and before when we were still doing live events at the Poison Pen. Well, we've always videoed our events. So, I mean, we've been doing this for decades. And so this was not even a big change for us, except we had to learn how to use Zoom. But most of them have said, particularly the thriller writers, that they hope they will live long enough to write about the years from 1916 to the present, because you know, you couldn't actually make it up. And it'll be really interesting to see how, even of a five-year perspective, how we may look back at this, how we look back now at McCarthy. I mean, I lived through McCarthy. And at the time, it was like we'd never get to the end of it. And we were so polarized. And you know, they've made movies now about the blacklist and other stuff. So when you're in it, you know, it's hard to have any perspective, but as you move away from it, I think that it will be a very fruitful topic for writers to explore, trying to make sense of it.
I don't doubt that for one second. David, of course, has a number of different characters and different series that he writes, the Archer series, which is his latest, but also he has other characters, and which I just find remarkable, the ability to do that. It would be interesting, the idea of putting fiction during the last few years that we've experienced, except the truth is so much stranger than the fiction could ever be. I mean, you know, you couldn't, if I had presented to you in 2012, any number of the plot developments that we actually lived through over the last 5 years, I think that you would say I was being a little heavy-handed, that my writing was a little too on the nose. Oh, so you're saying that Donald Trump refers to Baltimore as a shithole city, and then it turns out his son-in-law is actually a slumlord in Baltimore. That kind of thing, you couldn't
make it up. No,
that happened.
Most authors have said they don't really want to write about the pandemic, but I think that many people will certainly chew into what happened to the American psyche. And that's true of 1968 too. You know, that was another seminal year when all sorts of things happened that nobody would have been able to predict. So Patrick, why don't we call you up? I think you're there somewhere hiding. What happened to David? Were we never able to get him back?
I don't know. He's just been having some tech issues rejoining the meeting, and I don't know.
Well, we apologize to those of you who may have turned in the hope of talking to David Baldacci again, as we have been fortunate to do during the pandemic several times, and perhaps we can get him to join us in the future. But anyway, it's been a real pleasure to talk to Jake, just Jake. So
great. Anyway, it's been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah. Do you have questions that people have fielded to you?
Yeah. You know, as you know, juggling the demands kind of going forward with obviously your very, very busy day gig with the expectation of writing manuscripts, how are you going to juggle those two things? Has it been difficult?
My day gig and writing?
Yeah.
Well, my general rule on writing, as Barbara noted, is like, if you have a writing project, then you have to commit to writing every day. Whether that's George R.R. Martin has this, he says that writers are either architects or gardeners. The architects are the ones who come up with an outline and follow it. And the gardeners are the ones who just kind of write and just see what grows. I'm definitely an architect. I definitely outline the book. And then, so whether it's that or the writing or the researching, although I don't really consider researching writing, so I don't count it in the sitting down and doing 15 minutes a day. You just have to commit to it at least 15 minutes a day. You just have to make yourself do it. And even if what you write is garbage and you throw it out, or ultimately it's, you don't need it. I had a whole chapter that I did not include in this book that I got rid of because it just didn't advance the plot at all. But Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, lived in Palm Springs at the same time. So I had a scene where Charlie goes and Charlie and Margaret go and they visit with Dwight and Mamie Eisenhower, but it didn't add anything. So I just got rid of it. But even if what you're writing isn't any good, it's gotten you somewhere. It's eliminated something. It's made you, it's crystallized. 15 minutes every day. If that's all you do, by the end of the week, you got an hour, 45 minutes under your belt. That's, I don't know, 4 or 5 pages, it's something. And that's how I do it. So right now I'm kind of like in the germination stage of the next book in the series. But once I figure it out, once I decide whether I'm going to put it in the 70s or the 80s and the basic idea and the basic plot, then I'll commit to the 15 minutes a day.
Right. Are you a big crime fiction reader yourself? And who are some of your favorites?
I love David Baldacci, Harlan Coben. I love Michael Connelly. I love Gillian Flynn. I mean, there are so many. There are too many to name. I love Lee Child. I mean, they're all different, right? They're all so different. But they're great. I love just reading the masters of the craft. Michael Connelly has been focusing a lot on the Bosch TV series, which is so good, and I love. I mean, there are just so many. I'm also, I also read a lot of other types of fiction. I love Nick Hornby. I love Pete Dexter. But that's a lot. Right now I'm in the middle of Wind by Harlan Coben and Once Small Favor by David Baldacci.
It's so interesting.
Somebody asked me the other day about what book I love to reread. I'm like, I don't have time to reread anything. There's so many books I haven't read yet.
It's interesting talking about this era. You know, Barbara and I and other writers have talked about it a lot with, Phoenix in particular and its connection with Vegas and the Chicago mob and, all these fascinating kind of intersections happen here as sort of a playground for the Chicago mob in the 50s. And there are bits and pieces of that still here in Phoenix. Pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I loved writing. I have a couple scenes that take place in Vegas and I loved writing them because it just those non-LA, non-New York, non-Chicago places where the mob would go and have fun.
Right.
Vegas being one of them, Phoenix being another, lots of fun.
Is Patrick, James Elroy.
Patrick, you should announce that Patrick's actually the editor of Phoenix Noir, which is one of the books in the Akashic Urban Noir series.
Oh, awesome.
That was a lot of fun.
Amazing, amazing set of stories by some of the authors that you've already mentioned that you like. And, people think of Phoenix as just a modern city out here in the desert, largest geographical city now in the United States, the largest territorially. if not in population, because I think we're, I don't know, third or fifth largest in population, but an anomaly in the desert in the same way that Vegas is an anomaly in the desert. But the Chicago connections are really surprisingly strong.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. Were you just about to ask about Elmore Leonard?
Yeah.
What about him?
No, actually, I was going to ask you about James Ellroy.
James Ellroy, yes. A master, fantastic. American Tabloid was great. And Elmore Leonard, also fantastic. And Carl Hyacin, also fantastic. I mean, they're, like I said, there's so many. I hate even naming five because there's like 20 others that I'll forget. But like, yeah, James Ellroy's amazing.
Well, he shows you kind of the unsanitized view of these, of this era. And just when you peeled back the last layer of corruption, you think it can't get any darker. He peels one more back on you. LA Confidential in those books. Let's see. I have a question from Janet who says, question for Mr. Tapper. What was the most fun or surprising thing or story you learned about doing your research for this book? I'm sure there were quite a few.
Oh, so many. I mean, I don't know that there were any. There were just so many that were just so interesting. There's a lot of menacing things that happen in this book, and a lot of them are real, based on real things. But one kind of discovery that I made that I enjoyed making, although it's, again, it's not joyous, was reading Tippi Hedren's autobiography, Tippi. And Tippi Hedren and Janet Leigh are minor characters in my book, as, you know, major stars of 1961, 1962. Janet Leigh had just, she's on the set of the, she's one of the stars of The Manchurian Candidate. So Charlie and Margaret meet her. And she also just had starred in Psycho a couple years before. And Tippi Hedren is being filmed right then in The Birds with Hitchcock. Again, I don't want to give anything away, but some of just what they, just the lives of these people about whom I was familiar, but not in any intimate way, because they weren't major stars anymore by the time I was aware of film and everything, was just fascinating. Just some of the details about filming The Birds or Psycho were just kind of interesting to me, because I used to be a huge Hitchcock fan when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Psycho starts in Phoenix, downtown Phoenix.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That's where they steal the money. Oh, the Psycho, I'm thinking. Yeah, no.
Psycho.
That's where they steal the money from?
Yeah. Yeah, and then they head out. They head west. But we had, remember, Barbara, we had Cheryl Crane, who wrote a couple of mystery novels and also wrote a book about her mother, Lana Turner. And that was really interesting. A lot of great stories.
It really was. Actually, Jake's scene of our discussion about Psycho and how the shower scene was filmed is a really great reason to read this book. If for nothing else, if you're a Psycho fan, you definitely want to know what Jake has Janet Leigh say about how it all came down.
Well, Margaret runs in at the rap party for The Manchurian Candidate. Margaret bumps into Janet Leigh in the ladies' room. And if you are alive, and an adult in 1961, 1962, you have seen Psycho, and it was the most terrifying experience of your life, like bar none, because that filmmaking had never been done before. And she immediately asks, Margaret immediately asks Janet Leigh about it. And Janet Leigh answers in answers that I got from reading an interview Janet Leigh did, a couple interviews.
That was really terrifying. But I also say that, because I was, you know, not that old at that time, that when the rocking chair revolved around, that was actually almost as terrifying as the scene in the shower.
Oh, is
Psycho,
that right?
Psycho had a double punch.
Yeah.
It really did.
It's interesting to go back and look at that, you know, and I watched it again recently, and it's a very strange movie. There's a lot of interesting things going on that maybe we didn't notice the first time, you know, the taxidermy and the very
The Manchurian Candidate's like that too.
Yeah.
Watch it today, not the remake, but the 1962 one,
that's a trippy movie for 1962. I mean, considering that, you know, neither the writer nor the director, nobody was doing drugs. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
As far as we know.
You don't know that for sure, do you?
Well, no, I don't. But I mean, I've read a lot now about John Frankenheimer and the movie, and like there's no evidence that they were real, that they were, you know, dope fiends.
Well, Barbara met Robert Mitchum, and that was I'm jealous of that.
Came into the store. I'll never forget it. It was a Saturday afternoon. And you know what a wonderful voice he had? I mean, you could hear forever. And I had my head down. I was counting out, you know, the till. This is back when we were a little baby bookstore because we opened in 1989. And I had my head down and I was doing this. And all of a sudden, over the counter, this voice came at me. And I almost had a heart attack. I really did. I looked up and sure enough, there he was. It was an amazing moment. The other one that was really funny was we did a big event in 1999 for what was then called the American Achievement Academy. And it had like 18 Nobel Prize winners, and it had Martha Stewart, and it had Fritz Schulder. And I mean, just this panoply of people. And I was talking to Sue Grafton, and I looked across the room, and this little girl that we had working for us doing the kill had looked up, and I could see money flying up out of her hands and, you know, raining down all over the place because she looked up when she heard a voice, and it was James Earl Jones.
Oh, wow.
You know, there he was, Darth Vader, you know, and I still remember that. It was like this whole shower, you know, just went up because she was just paralyzed by excitement at hearing his voice. Some people have voices like that.
Oh, yeah. Robert Mitchum's in the same scene in my book, in The Daisy, the private club.
Yeah.
He's there talking with, I think, Gregory Peck, because they are shooting Cape Fear, which takes place in Georgia, but they couldn't film it in Georgia because of Robert Mitchum's criminal record.
Exactly.
And the fact that he had served on a chain gang in Georgia, so they had to shoot it in Northern California.
Was that his pot bust?
Yeah, his son lived in Scottsdale, which is the reason that he was there. But yeah, no, it was a great moment. I mean,
that's great. You know, I'm jealous you got to meet him. How cool.
He was a real Renaissance man, very, very learned, literate, you know, guy, wrote plays and a lot of things people don't associate with him, perhaps. Well, I do have one more question, and then we should probably wrap it up here. What are some of your, this is from Sabrina, who we know. What are some of your favorite old movies? And you've talked a little bit about this, but she asks, can you speak again about The Manchurian Candidate and how it played into The Devil May Dance? And are there any other old movies you feel your readers must see?
Well, I do think every movie that I mention in the book are must-sees, whether it's Psycho or The Birds or Cape Fear or The Manchurian Candidate. Sabrina's excited because we did we pitched it to them or they pitched it to us, but I'm doing an introduction of The Manchurian Candidate because of The Manchurian Candidate in the book. And I do think it's just such an interesting movie, and it's so of its time that here's another story you'll appreciate. So Arthur Krim, who was the head of United Artists Movies, United Artists Productions, which makes The Manchurian Candidate, distributes it. Arthur Krim was also a major Democratic fundraiser and advisor. His studio gets the rights to the Richard Condon book, The Manchurian Candidate, and then they decide, Krim just squashes it. We're not going to make this movie. It's too weird. It's going to hurt President Kennedy. He's trying to negotiate with the Soviets. We can't have a movie in which there's all this conspiracies and brainwashing and an assassination. We can't do that. Sinatra goes, again, this is a true story. Sinatra goes to Hyannis Port and begs Kennedy, please let us make this movie. Arthur Krim won't, but you could ask him to let us make it. Kennedy has already read the book, The Manchurian Candidate. So he's like, sure, that's great. Who'd you get to play the mom? Because in the book, the mom, played by Angela Lansbury in the movie, but the that relationship's even crazier in the book than it is in the movie. Anyway, so Kennedy asks Arthur Krim, let them make it. So they make it. That's how intricately all this world is weird and back scratching and intertwined, which is why it was so serendipitous that I decided to make this the setting for the book. And then also that's when Sinatra was shooting The Manchurian Candidate. It's just so weird. And then to top it all off, as I said, the book ends with the Madison Square Garden performance, a John F. Kennedy's birthday party and fundraiser, where Marilyn Monroe sings Happy Birthday, Mr. President. And there's only one photograph of John F. Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe taken, period, one, even though they spent time together. And that is, this is real, after the Madison Square party, at a private event at the townhouse of Arthur Krim. So that is the last scene in the book. They're at Arthur Krim's house, because that's in real life where Kennedy was, where Robert Kennedy was, where Marilyn Monroe was. So that's where the book ends, just because it's all so weird and incestuous.
That's amazing.
Fascinating. Wow.
Well, this has been an absolutely, I'm so sorry that we're missing David, because I'm sure he would have taken this whole interview in a different direction. But
I had a great time.
Well, thank you. We have had a great time also. And maybe we could bring David back and have a follow-up book discussion where we could talk about the whole book at some point. You know, that would really be, I think, a lot of fun. And you know what, Jake? People tune into those from all over the world. Patrick and I were just blown away the first one we did with Brad Thor. And we had people we had some guy email us from New Zealand who said he's afraid he'd fall asleep during the discussion. So here was
There's another author I love, Brad Thor. I love his stuff. Great.
I do too. And we're going to launch him in July. But anyway, they're a lot of fun, so we could talk about it. So if you could stick around for a minute after Patrick takes us off Facebook, sure. I have a great Joe Kennedy story to tell you that you will enjoy, sounds but good. I don't want to
thanks
waste
everybody for time. Watching. I hope you like
it. Thank you all very, very much. It's been a real pleasure. And don't forget that we do have autographed copies of The Devil May Dance. And I will also say that it is going to be our historical fiction book of the month for June. Yay. So that'll be great. Good night, everybody. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.